Hello everyone and welcome to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. I'm your host, Eddie Palmgren, and with me in the studio this time is my friend and colleague, Martin Wahlström, who is an analyst here at Redeye. How are you?
I'm good, Eddie. I'm happy to be back in sunny Stockholm after a nice vacation, and I'm also happy to be back in the podcast studio for a second time.
Yes, today we also have the pleasure of welcoming back Stephen Penman. And Stephen is a professor emeritus of accounting and security analysis at Columbia Business School. He has been elected into the Accounting Hall of Fame and is also a distinguished author. In episode 52, we had the pleasure of discussing his book Accounting for Value. So, Martin, which one will we speak about this time?
Today we'll speak about his latest book, which is Financial Statement Analysis for Value Investing, which partly at least builds upon the ideas presented in Accounting for Value. He has written it together with Peter Pope, and at 400 plus pages, it's really providing ample material for investors willing to go the extra mile. However, it is a practical book with many examples of how to think about accounting as well as value investing.
Financial Statement Analysis for Value Investing was published by Columbia Business School Publishing in 2025, and we are delighted to have its author on the show today. Here comes our conversation with Stephen Penman. Hi, Stephen, and welcome to Investing by the Books podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Eddie, and Martin for asking me to join you. I look forward to our discussion.
Last time we spoke in 2023, you were in Milan, and since then we have also met in Omaha this spring. So where are we reaching you today?
Well, I'm back in New York. I'm sitting at in my apartment looking out at Riverside Park and the Hudson River. Very, very nice, and actually it's a cool day for once, so I'm a little happy. Yep.
Wonderful. And last week you were a keynote speaker at the conference Accounting and Accountability for Climate Change in Finland next to us. How was the conference?
Oh, the conference was very good. I'm sort of a new at this. I've had a good friend we were assistant professors together in Berkeley, who's now head of a climate institute in Mannheim University, Stefan Reichelstein. And he's got me interested in this. So I sort of got into it, sort of writing about how you would prepare accounting reports for firms reporting on their carbon and their emissions and their remissions. And so it's a helpful balance sheet and income statement accounting, which I believe as accounting is in financial accounting, is very quite informative. So I presented that at the conference. It's not my usual line of business, but it was very fun, and I think quite useful and important.
And today we will speak about your latest book, Financial Statement Analysis for Value Investing. Would you like to describe kind of what the book is about?
Well, the book is, as it says, it's for value investors and how to handle the accounting, basically, again, how to do the analysis, the accounting, and bring the accounting into the analysis. As the book very much stresses, value investing is first about understanding the business, okay? That's primary, but then you've got to understand the measurements and how that flows into the accounting and how it doesn't flow into the accounting. You know, as Buffett says, the first thing I do is understand the business, and then I pick up the 10K and devour it. So that's the basic theme of the book, with warnings about how the accounting helps you, how it doesn't help you. It helps you a lot, and takes you through formally how to do it. So it's not just ideas. The formal book we talked about last time we met a couple of years ago was Accounting for Value, and that was sort of gave the themes and the ideas. This really flushes it out to take through. This is how you might do it. So this is written in much more activist style from the point of view, you are an active value investing. This is how you've got to think about it, and this is how you want to approach it. And it's written in an activist style, a more conversational style, which I hope will appeal to practitioners and investors, but also to students as a different way of reading a textbook.
And the difference with this book is that you have compiled it together with Peter Pope. Who is he?
Yes. Peter Pope is a longtime friend, it turns out. He was at the University of Lancaster in UK. He came and visited Berkeley when we were both very young professors back in the 80s. I got to know him because he came with his wife and a baby, and we just had the baby at the same time. So we pushed strollers around Berkeley and talked about things. Okay. He's been at the Cass School in London, now Bay School. He was a professor at LSE, but he moved to Bocconi probably 6-7 years ago. And he actually adopted my accounting for value class that I teach at Columbia. And we helped develop it there at Bocconi, where I've been visiting, as you know, for several years. And we just talked more and more about it. And so it led to a collaboration.
Great. And how did you split the work between you with the book?
I think many of the ideas come from that accounting the value class, and also from my previous books and so on. He's very good. He's the editor of the Journal of Business, Finance and Accounting, which is the prime capital markets journal in UK and Europe. So he had very good ideas about how to present it all and lay it out. It was very, very helpful. It took me a little bit out of my silo, as it were. And so it was very much collaborative effort. We drafted it out, and then we wrote, and he then wrote much better than I did. We worked on the cases from our classes, the exercises. See, it's a book. Actually, I see it. We see it aimed largely at practitioners, okay, who want to do fundamental investing. But it's also a text, so it has all the case studies and exercises and all those sorts of things that go along with teaching materials. It was a very enjoyable collaboration.
And one central theme in the book is that you encourage investors to keep an accounting book and do investing by the book, which for our listeners might be a bit confusing, as that was also the name of the podcast show.
Well, you know, I didn't realize, I knew, of course, but it had passed over me that your sequence is called Investing by the Book. And actually, I thought a good title for the book, and maybe subliminally I was influenced by your title, the original was Investing by the Book. That's what I wanted to call it, okay? The publisher, who's the Columbia University Press, said, well, you know, that's maybe not quite doesn't resonate, okay? And if you're looking at it as a textbook as well, you probably want to put in the terms of courses that are called financial statement analysis. So we changed the name. But Martin, the idea here is that when you invest, you keep a book. You keep a book on the firm. I think accounting is a very natural thing. We do a lot of mental accounting. So when I meet you first time, Martin or Eddie, I say, are these guys an asset or a liability? Will a relationship with them add value? Now we do that all the time. We do that when we approach a job. We do that when we approach marriage. We do that mentally. And I think when it comes to a business, of course, you've got to do more formally, how to actually keep a book on the firm and track the firm, and then how to extract from that book to get insights about their ability to generate growth and the risk of the firm also. So that's the idea. So that's one of the themes of the book, actually, is let's lay out how to keep this book, okay? It just doesn't deal with flows, earnings or cash flows. There's a balance sheet there. And one of the emphases of the book is this balance sheet is very important, because accounting, balance sheets, income statements work together to indicate value. And you've always got to use them together. And that does solve a lot of problems. For example, intangible assets aren't on the balance sheet. Okay. And that seems a remiss of accounting. But if the earnings from the intangible assets, the earnings from Coca-Cola's brand is coming through the income statement, it doesn't matter. Okay? You can get the valuation from the flows. Other firms, you've got to use both the income statement and balance sheet. So that's one of the themes that come out in terms of this this keeping a book.
And many of our listeners are using other valuation frameworks, for example, the discounted cash flow method. And in your book, you discourage several common valuation frameworks, and using free cash flows is one of them. So how do you think investors should think about cash flows?
Well, I think if you want a one-liner, it's just not good accounting, okay? And that, just to elaborate, yes, free cash flow is cash coming in from operations. We like that stuff. That's good. But then it's minus cash investment. And so it treats investments as a negative, okay? The higher your investment, the lower the free cash flow. So if you look at free cash, think about free cash flows, next year, the following year, and the firms are doing a lot of vesting for growth, it's a low free cash flow. Now, ultimately, it's a model which is consistent with no arbitrage. If you forecast all the way to the future when those investments pay off, you'll pick it up. But another theme of the book, in the long run, we're all dead, okay? And predicting the long run, it gives me very serious psychological problems. And so that's the basic thing. No, it's investments. You don't treat as a bad. You maybe put it on the balance sheet. And so here's an investment to which we're looking for firms to add value to the investment. And that'll come through an income statement. So that puts you into balance sheets, the balance sheets and income statements that I was talking about.
And one thing that I find very interesting with the book is kind of all these adjustments. To some extent, it is a quite technical book in the adjustments that are made, and they can be quite time consuming if you do all of them. I was wondering, kind of, is this always worth it, or are there kind of situations where investors can benefit from taking, let's say, quicker decisions with less information?
No, you're right. There is the full treatment here, okay? The full Monty. You're looking for shortcuts, and the shortcuts there, and the way the book builds, I think those shortcuts come out. So, for example, you can just trade on PE ratios, okay, which is just or price to book ratios, which only use one bit of information or two bits of information, so earnings and book values, and you can screen on that. The book puts out that's very dangerous. It's very dangerous because you're ignoring information. So, but that's a very simple method, okay, and all simple methods are great because they're simple. But as I think it was tribute to Einstein, he said, we want to be simple, but not too simple. And so then the question is, can you expand the information? Okay. And the book gives you the full treatment, how you might do that. But at any point in time, you say, this is not worth it. I'm just going to cut off here and take the risk that maybe there's some information I'm ignoring. And a lot of the detailed accounting that goes through in the later chapters on the accounting are, most times don't turn up in any case. And so if you trade on a PE ratio, we'll say, oh, maybe I'll introduce growth and I'll have a PEG ratio. Well, that's an improvement, okay, because you're building in the growth. But then there's dangers of that. So that's the way the book is structured. And yes, I tell you what, I don't go through the full treatment every time, okay? I understand the company. This is worth looking into. Now I'll go to some summary metrics to start with. Well, the price to book, I might look at the book rate of return. Okay. I might look at the persistence of the book rate of return. But rarely do I go into the full detail that a student is encouraged to lay out in their spreadsheet. So they have a tool here which has everything in it, most of which they ignore, but everything is there, okay? I will always sit down, of course, and look at the quality and the integrity of the accounting. So that's the way it goes. So it's not you have to do all of this and bash your head against the wall to get any. No, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. And I think you captured it quite well with the quote, ignore information at your peril. I think that is... really say something. Another thing that I kind of thought a bit about was that in chapter 8 you say, and this ties back to Eddie's previous question, that you kind of disregard some common concepts in finance. you say that the required return is a personal matter. Can you explain what you mean by this and how the active investors can go about establishing their required return?
Yeah, I mean, the point of departure there is finance for 70 years, 80 years, we've been in this pursuit of finding the cost of capital, measuring it, okay? And I think I say in the book, there's 5 Nobel Prize given for the effort, from Miller through Hansen and Farmer and so on. But I think it's best to think there's no such thing as the cost of capital. We can't find it. There's a dirty little secret in finance. We got all the models of it, but we can't really tell you how to do it. And these factor models, in my mind, all these factor models are just playing with mirrors. Okay, they're based on data dredging, not on good fundamental analysis. So with that opening statement, it's a personal matter. So here's a story. I think it's actually in the book, maybe in that chapter 8. Back in 2008, in the global financial crisis, I was teaching. And it was November of that year where things were looking pretty bad. You know, S&P 500 dropped to 667 eventually, I think. And that morning in the New York Times, Warren Buffett came out and said, now is the time to buy stocks. Okay? Because he looks for those episodes. So I brought the New York Times into class and said, well, are you guys buying, are you people buying stocks? And I got no yeses at all. And I said, why aren't you buying stocks? And one person got up and said, well, first of all, we're doing MBAs. We're looking for a job at the end of the year in the finance business. And the whole damn thing's crashing. We don't think we're going to get a job. It's very risky for us to buy stocks. Secondly, we have student debt to the ceiling. Okay, we're highly levered already. We can't do it. It's just too risky. We're not sure what's going to happen here. This is a global financial crisis. They, in other words, saying they have a very high hurdle rate. Mm-hmm. And as most people at the time fleeing stocks because they were levered, because they were worried, they're fleeing stocks, not buying them. It's all right for Warren Buffett, who has, I think, still at the time, a triple A rating and has, you know, a certain history for making good decisions. But he's got a lower hurdle rate. And they said to me, hey, Professor, are you buying stocks? And I said, well, yes, I am. I'm looking at things. But you've got to understand, I have a lower hurdle rate, a lower cost of capital. I'm a professor. I have... Columbia University is silly enough to give me tenure. I cannot be fired, okay? I don't have any much debt. Even my mortgage is paid off, okay? So, yeah, I'll go for it. Now, it could not turn out. But I think that's indicative that we all have a different hurdle rate. So that's the book says, when you invest, you put in your own hurdle rate, okay? Put in your own hurdle rate. In this environment, I am requiring 12%, 13%, okay? For this type of firm, I'm a venture capitalist. I'm wanting 30%, okay? For this very mature firm, I'll put up with 8%. Mm-hmm. And that'll adjust with the risk-free rate, of course. But I think that's the way to think about it. But to think that you can actually, through analysis, go out and find the cost of capital, it's 8.3%, not 8.5%, is a fool's notion. So that's why I think about it. And one thing in value investing we say is, you've got to be honest. One of the things of the book is, understand what you know and what you don't know. And don't go on what you don't know. That's speculation. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way I think about it. Now I can do some analysis on the financials and give you some indications of the risk, okay? But I can't tell you how to map that risk into its 8.3%. Mm-hmm.
I like the expression you use in the book, fantasy thinking, that investors should avoid this.
Yeah. Well, this fantasy thinking is is sort of the extreme of speculation. You know, you see it with a lot of the meme investing and some of the crypto stuff, particularly earlier on, you know, just running fantasies, persuading yourself of these fantasies, which, you know, we call self-deception.
And one thing that was mentioned, I think, also in Chapter 8, which is at least partly related, is you touch upon how fund managers should think about setting their hurdle rate. And this is connected, of course, to the central theme of the book, residual earnings, kind of only being compensated on what they generate after creating true value.
Yes.
It would be interesting to hear your thoughts on kind of how fund structures should be designed more generally.
Yes, I must say, I don't think I have a complete answer there. One thing I think in running a value fund, a fundamental fund, is knowing your investors. A lot of fund managers see their investors as partners. They're in the same boat together. And so that seems to be important, because if, in fact, there is a bit of a drawdown, you don't get the investors running. They stay with you because they actually understand what you're doing. So I guess the answer would be, well, what is our typical hurdle rate for our investors? Okay, it's going to be greater than the risk-free rate, but I can't tell you. I really can't tell you how to set, but I can tell you how to think about. You are operating as a fiduciary duty for investors, sort of figure out what is their tolerance. And if you're a good partnership, you're talking to your investors. Okay. In terms of structure, you know, you could argue that it all should be incentive, okay, of covering that cost of capital. I don't think that's quite realistic, because particularly as you're building a fund, you do have costs, so you need a little bit of a percentage of AUM, okay, to hold you in there. And I think your investors understand that. But the idea, you know, it's 2.5% of APM and no incentive, seems to me to be a bit out of whack with how you serve your investors.
I think your ideas are quite aligned with the type of investors that we regularly speak to here at Red Eye, many family offices and other investors who are really long-term, and their base of...
Yes.
Investors who are putting money into their funds, they usually also understand what they're doing, and they're keeping also a long-term view. So I think that is important. But many of our listeners are also interested in M&A and acquisitions and companies that drive growth through acquisitions. And you have dedicated one chapter to special situations where you discuss value added through M&A, among other things. So it would be interesting to hear your thoughts on M&A from an accounting perspective.
Well, from accounting perspective, of course, you've got to think about what the current accounting is. And it's a horrible mess. Okay. I've actually just written a paper on a year or so ago on a proposal for a different accounting for goodwill. Okay, and I was actually on a panel with Christine Bodesan, who's on the FASB at the Triple American Accounting Association conference in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, talking about it. But the current accounting, you know, it says, well, you want to acquire this firm. You go out and you get the fair value of all the individual assets and liabilities, and you tote them up, and then you sort of guess at the fair value of some intangible assets, and you put on the balance sheet. And then there's the market price, which you pay. The sum of the fair values of all these assets you can identify and the market price, we're going to call that goodwill. Now, it's just a plug number with no real interpretation at all. So if you're going to amortize it or you're going to impair it, what are you impairing? So... it's the only case in accounting where we actually calculate things by a plug. Under double entry, things are calculated in two ways. Equity is accounted by assets and liabilities plus opening equity plus the earnings minus the dividends. It's all accounted for, okay? But this is by a plug. So the basic thing, which is not covered in the book, by the way, but I have a paper on it now that your listeners can get from SSRN, of laying out a different accounting where you understand what's in goodwill. The trouble with the fair value of individual assets is you're not buying individual assets. You're buying the value that's generated by the residual assets. Mm-hmm. Because they generate value jointly. There's no such thing as a value for a standalone asset, for an asset used jointly, except for a standalone asset. I mean, for a security you hold, a debt security, there's a fair value. But for these, so it's not the fair value of what you're buying. So the idea is now using that residual income model of understanding the fair value of the assets used jointly, and that's based on the earnings that the target is generating.
What's the name of the paper?
A proposal for goodwill accounting. Okay, it's on ssrn.com. And actually, you get into a big thing. One thing people refer to very much is the price premium paid. Okay, that's never in the accounting. But this now I have an accounting for explaining what's in the price premium. So that's what I get straight first. But that actually is not in the book. I'm saying, well, this is how you have to handle the accounting as it is, okay, understanding these problems. But in terms of looking at the acquisition and measuring the performance of the acquisition, the idea is exactly the same in the book. Yeah, you've got to look at the consolidated balance sheet and the value being generated from the consolidated balance sheet, which, of course, is the earnings, the target's earnings and the acquirer's earnings plus any synergies, and you evaluate on that basis. And then very importantly, you have to determine the allocation of that total value between the acquirer and the target. Mm-hmm. So now, as it is, it's really a way for each board, the acquirer and the target, to evaluate their, as the proposal comes to the board, how to evaluate it. And it's definitely not based on cash flows, okay? It's based on earnings, projected earnings and balance sheets. And then the split there in terms of the purchase terms, either in cash or in a share issue, is terms of the split between the acquirer and the target.
And throughout the book, you separate between what you call good and bad thinking, encouraging, of course, people to avoid bad thinking. But in the introduction, you also refer to Kahneman's work with thinking fast and slow. So I was wondering if you consider good thinking and slow thinking to be kind of equivalent in this context, or if you should consider those two separately.
I think so, yes. Perhaps I hadn't really thought through thoroughly the reference to Kahneman, but I like his ideas, okay. Thinking on the spot versus being very very patient and very dedicated about doing. And value investing has to be a good slow thinking, okay, thinking it through. And the book is, that's what the book's there for, to help you develop that. And that slow thinking, it just doesn't come from reading a book. It comes from doing it for quite a while. We're learning all the time. The quick thing in value investing, the quick thinking, of course, is the day traders, I guess. And this is not day trading. I guess is a time when you might have to think quickly if there's a sudden drawdown. Okay, do I go now or do I wait? Okay. Although the long term thinking is probably comes into that also. Mm. There's trusting our immediate instincts, I think, is very dangerous. Okay. The stock price has gone up. Maybe I should jump in. And quick thinking, it has to be, in some sense, for someone who doesn't have the long thing. I want to get in the stock market. I want to do it, but I don't have the background, or I'm not going to pay the 2% on AUM for an advisor. So I just do some. I've used my basic intuition thinking, but of course, that's dangerous.
And now we have been going through some of the concepts in the book and the kind of high-level ideas, but we recommend everyone to buy it and read it in full, of course. Is there something that we haven't touched upon that you would like to mention here?
Well, I think one of the approaches in the book, which was also in the Accounting for Value book, is a skepticism about valuation models, a discounted cash flow valuation model, or even a residual income model. Here is the model. Plug in the aspects of it. Yep, get some forecasts, plug in your disk hurdle rate, plug in a growth rate, and it drops out, okay? And you go back to the fundamental investors, and they say this doesn't work. There's a very good quote in the book that I picked up from Charlie Munger, who said, you know, in business schools, they teach you to forecast in the future, put in a growth rate, and discount it back. He says it's totally stupid, and then he says they do this in business schools, but I guess they have to do something. But no, so there's too much speculation. Just building in a growth rate, a long-term growth rate, is not doing much. So the approach taken is a standard reverse engineering approach. Morbison and Rappaport introduced these ideas many years ago, where first of all you do some accounting based on balance sheets and income statement and forecasts of earnings you might have for the next year or possibly 2 years ahead. You get the valuation based on that without any growth, and then you compare that to the market price, which tells you the price that the market's putting on growth and the growth rate that the market is pricing. And that's, so you're using the models sort of in reverse engineering form. And that's where your fundamental analysis starts. Do I agree with the market? This is Benjamin Graham's negotiating with Mr. Mark. He's asking you to pay something. Do I want to pay that? But it's also always in the growth. That is the way the way it goes. And when you come to think about it, as we point out in the book, accounting evaluation thinks that the onus is on you to go out and find the intrinsic value. And the book actually says, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, there's no such thing as intrinsic value. You can't find it. No, you go into the woods and try and look for it. You really can't find it, okay? But that's not what investment is. It's not a game against nature. It's a game against other investors. All you have to do is agree with other investors or disagree with other investors, okay? And after all, you can only buy or sell or hold. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of, I think, very helpful and liberating idea of how to think about investing. But first, you've got to understand the market's thinking. Mm-hmm. And I find that very helpful because sometimes I say, well, it's Mr. Market. So sorry, ladies, I'm using a he here. He's thinking this. What does he know that I don't know? Okay. And so that's the negotiation. And I think it's a very useful way of setting up your mental thinking, okay, about the whole problem.
Let's shift focus a bit to your current engagements. It's been a bit more than 2 years ago since we talked last time. What has happened since then? What are your current roles?
Well, quite a lot's happened, I think. First of all, I've now retired from Columbia, formally retired. So I'm an emeritus. I still have an office there. I still go to seminars. I interact with PhD students, particularly, and master's students and faculty. I've taught my last class, but I'm keeping up all the old bad habits. I'm writing papers, I'm writing books, as you see. I'm very involved in it, and I'm still doing that. I am not retired. As we accountants say, it's form over substance. I don't play golf, much to my father's regret, but this is my habit, which I very much enjoy. The wonderful thing about the liberating thing is I don't go to faculty meetings. I'm not on committees. I think I did my service both at Berkeley and at Columbia, but this thinking about these complex institutions and how you can contribute and how things are done, and so it takes a lot of mental thinking, and so I've been able to put that aside and to push more on the substantive investing side of things. So that's been quite liberating, and I think it was timely because, as you probably heard, Columbia's been in a turmoil in the last couple of years with the Trump administration's movements. So the other thing is I've finished my time as a distinguished professor at Bocconi University. That finished up in this last June. So I'm not going back to Bocconi in any formal way now. So I got plenty of time.
And Stockholm, you have been here previously, but...
Well, I've been to Stockholm a number of times, yes. I've been twice or three times, I think, as a visiting professor on sabbaticals, the Jan Wellander visiting professorship there. I also spent some time at the Swedish Institute of Finance, I think it was, which is just a little bit up the hill from the school, the Stockholm School. I've passed through there quite regularly. Last year I went up and gave a seminar and talked to people. I have very good friends from those days, a guy by the name of Lars Bultmar, who was once a CEO of Carnegie, the investment bank before it, in its good times. He has a house out in Blidur, an island called Blidur out on the archipelago. Being out there, and stayed out there in high summer, very much enjoying it. So I passed by there.
And last time we also spoke about the need for better accounting in the world, both in governments, but also in companies and businesses, and also about your work in the area. So have you seen any major changes since then or something coming?
I don't think since that time, 2 years ago, there's been any major changes. Obviously, the FASB and the IASB, IFRS people have bitten around the edges, cleaning a few things up. Their major advances in terms of revising revenue recognition, bringing operating leases on the balance sheet, we're already there. I think the major thing that's hit has been the changing the income accounting for unrealized gains and losses on equity securities, which now go into the income statement rather than through other comprehensive income. That, I believe, and we talk about this in the book, is a frustration for value investors because two things. One thing is you get prices into the accounting, and as the book warns, be very careful when you put prices in the accounting if you're trying to do an analysis to challenge the prices. Okay. But it also, it really gives a lot of volatility to your bottom line earnings. Warren Buffett has barked about this quite a bit. Now strip that out. That's not sustainable income. Okay. I think the position the boards are in at the moment is looking at some larger issues. One is business combinations, but another is intangible assets. That's a big one. And my impression is, and I'm not that close to it, though I talk to the people in the business, they're trying to work out how to deal with this intangible asset problem. There are a lot of loud noises saying your accounting is bad because you don't have intangible assets on the balance sheet. Okay. And so R&D has got to be capitalized on the balance sheet. But they're wrestling with this. My position is that it's not good accounting. You put R&D on the balance sheet, and the probability of success, I think the unconditional probability is about only 15%, okay? And in some areas, it's much lower than that. To put on the balance sheet and pretend you have an asset which increases your asset to debt ratio, making you look less risky is not appropriate. It makes you look more risky. You're actually more risky. So I've written a lot on tangible assets, okay, which your listeners can follow. Another issue is if you put R&D on the balance sheet, it doesn't tell you anything, okay? You about the problem of the outcome. All it tells you was they spent some money on R&D. And unless you have a lot of supplementary accounting that tells you about the probability, you come from the balance sheet. All it tells you, there's an expenditure on R&D, doesn't tell you anything. But there's another problem is you put on the balance sheet, what's the amortization schedule? You don't have a product as yet. You don't have revenues yet. You may not have them with high probability. If you start amortizing something, which you're very uncertain about the outcome, you screw up your income statement. So this is my thinking about it. I'm sorry. I'm using your question as an excuse. But they're wrestling this. And I know they're wrestling it very much, both on the two boards, other boards around the world. And so it'd be interesting to see. So I think there's a lot of number of back burner issues going on there. But nothing, but an answer to your question, nothing particularly dramatic. Another issue on the back burner is financial statement presentation, okay? And as you know, in the book, we distinguish between operating assets and financing assets, okay? That's very important for a value investor, where they distinguish between current assets and long-term assets and current assets and long current liability. It's a credit analysis. So I think a lot of work can be done on that one. And that's a back burner issue, which could be actually a big change in the future. But let me just say, I believe that from using it for a long time and thinking about it, that the accounting is basically good accounting, particularly as they've cleaned up on leases and revenue recognition and so on. It's basically good accounting. The stock option accounting is bad. Mm-hmm. One thing in the last several years is more pulling back from fair value accounting. Fair value accounting for individual assets, as I said later, is not the value of the assets in use, what they generate. It's appropriate in many cases to have fair value as a standalone asset, like a security you hold, or a derivative which is covering gains or losses on the hedged items. But at one time, I thought, wait, before the financial crisis, there was a strong movement, particularly in the international accounting, to move to fair value accounting for assets. Let's not have the historical cost of our plant. Let's put the estimated fair value of the plant. Well, there's no such thing because it's used with everything else that goes on. So, but that's, I think the financial crisis, when we saw, even for the financial institutions, the huge crashes in fair values was a very, very important lesson. I think that lesson has become ingrained now.
Very interesting to hear your thoughts on this. Something that most people are talking about is AI and the development there. What is your view from an accounting perspective on the long-term impact of AI?
Well, Eddie, I think I'm trying to work it out. Okay, I'm treating this as a spectator sport, watching to see what it involves. I'm of the opinion or the bias that in terms of the thinking that's in this book, it's a bit of a task for AI, but it can do it. We have a separate web page for the book, and there's a lot of additional material for each chapter. And each chapter we have a thing called an AI monitor. And we're inviting readers to actually, when they see developments, that helps things in this chapter tell us about it, which some of them are doing. So for example, I asked them to apply the residual income model, Perplexity and chat GPT. It comes back with very routine answers, okay, you know, pretending that here's the input you need, plug them in, and it all drops out on my left hand side. So, but I got to stand back because I am not going to get into it, okay? My students are much more into it. I can't do Python even, okay? And it may be very, very helpful. I can see some dimensions to be very, very helpful. But getting that intuition of really understanding the business and translating that into accounting numbers that then connect with prices, I see that as a step which is going to be a hard one to do with credibility. But let's wait and see. Maybe in 2 years you won't have to buy this book.
Something else which would be interesting to hear about is any potential changes to your own portfolio and your investing. You don't need to mention, of course, individual names, but perhaps more generally.
Not in terms of approach. With the prices of some stocks at particular levels, I have sold some, thinking that I can't justify the value anymore. I've pared back holdings in some of the tech that I had, okay? Banks I'm getting more worried about because they've been very successful. And I've looked at other areas where I think this is worth looking at. Done quite a bit of research. Got to US home builders, for example, I don't follow the view that the stock market's overvalued and you've got to get out. If you're just a passive investor buying the S&P 500, or maybe you want to get out, okay? But the variation in terms of the valuation and undervaluations I see is huge. There's many out there that, you know, yes, a lot of particularly the tech stocks look pricey, okay? And actually, I'm in few of them because, you know, I don't really understand tech. Okay, and certainly if they're all betting on AI, and they're all betting, you know, $1 trillion on AI in aggregate, who's going to win? Who's got no idea? Okay, so, but further down in terms of, I guess on average more medium size or small stocks typically, but outside those major ones that are driving the S&P 500, there's stocks that are worth looking at. So that's where I am. But in terms of the basic approach, no, it's just the same.
And a follow-up on that, now that you've scaled back your efforts a little bit, at least at Bocconi and Columbia, are you spending more time on investing your own savings?
I don't think so. I'm spending a lot of more time on research. I'm spending about the same amount of time on investment. And I've got to say, haven't been a full-time investor. I read and I say, well, let me go and look at this one, okay? It's not as if I go through the whole potential stocks and do a very thorough screen and so on. So I've always been a weekend warrior, as it were, on investing, okay? Because I had a day job, and I think that's pretty much the same. But when I do it, it's very, very thorough, okay? So that has not changed. But I haven't taken on myself, I'm just going to be an investor. I haven't done that because I have these curiosities that are still there, you know, and nag at me.
As this is a book podcast, we like to wrap up with a few questions on reading and writing. And at the end of your book, you recommend investors to read widely. So I'm curious if you have one or two titles that you could mention and recommend us to help us become better investors.
Well, there's two types of books that I really get into. Well, first of all, I've read those. I believe the Enlightenment was a very important development in what you might call Western civilization. Okay. And to understand the principles of the Enlightenment and what they have to say is very important. So there are texts like, well, obviously Smith and Hume and Bacon and so on, okay, those Scottish and English Enlightenment, some European Enlightenment writers. I think you need to understand that, okay? That's broad thinking. The second thing is, I don't read many non-fictional books. I read a lot of fiction, and fiction actually gives me an insight into life, humanity, you might say. Okay, I'm reading a book now for Italian American woman who about life in in a immigrant Italian conclave in New Jersey, where she grew up under. It's quite an amusing book, a good characterization, but with the strictures of the family with all their Italian and church heritage and so on, and her problems with that, and then going to Italy to where she thought she'd find relief, but running into other issues. I find that very, very, very. It's more of a woman's book actually, but I find that very, very, very helpful. In terms of, I read some of the classics, Trollope, for example, in English. It's very hard to read. It's very old-fashioned English. But, man, there are so many lessons there about life and politics and, you know, crony capitalism and all the things that plague us today. So, but I think, I believe good value investors are humanists, okay? They learn. They have broader lessons in life. You get that from Buffett in his quips, okay? And to have that perspective passed on to your kids, okay? And if they listen. So I think that's very important. And keep up, of course, you're reading that. I think it's very, very helpful and gives you a, I'm just speaking personally, it gives you a sort of a contentment with life. Okay, it gives you aggregation if someone like a Donald Trump comes along, you know. It gives you aggregation. And I do worry for the world a lot, okay, because of these tendencies. But having a coolness and reconciliation to life and its humanities and the challenges, and I think that's very helpful in terms of dealing with risk in investing, which we can't. We can do a little bit of analysis and get rid of some of the risk, but we're always sitting there facing it.
You have also written numerous journal articles, working papers and books. Do you have any new material in mind or in the making?
Yes, so one of my endeavors, I'm in a university. I'm really focused on accounting and value investing. And on the other side of things, in terms of investing, is this factor investing, okay? And I'm very skeptical about factor investing. Most of it comes from data dredging. The Farmer and French models, you know, it's just data dredging. And interestingly enough, it's picking up some accounting numbers, price to book, return on equity, investment, and so on. Not understanding what this is telling you. So my current work is going through this and explaining how you interpret this under the accounting principles that generate these numbers, okay? And where that tells you have got a risk factor or not, or an imperfect risk factor. And then doing some empirical work against what we get out of value investing relative to these factor models. I had trouble talking to my finance colleagues, many of whom I admire. Farmer, I very much admire. He was one of my professors, okay? Because they don't have the aesthetic of how accounting works. And I think this is sort of a lacking thing generally, both from some investors, academics, but investors, they don't really quite understand what accounting can give you. It's very rich if you know how to handle it. So that's what I'm engaged in. And that's an academic endeavor, but it also comes across as for practitioners. So this last April, I had a paper in Financial Analyst Journal, which is the journal for the CFAs, and the Journal of Portfolio Management, which is applying some of this work to on a practical basis. That's helpful to practitioners. I think it's a serious issue because I read there's $1 trillion under management under factor investing, and I don't think people understand the fundamentals underlying these factors and what they're getting into. So that's the current direction. And of course, I'm looking at carbon.
And would you like to write anything in fiction?
I don't think I'm going to do that. I've had fantasy as I read good writing. I think that this, could I do that? But I think it's a, now it's too late to actually get into it. And I think disappointment is the more likely thing not just being published, but disappointed of whether you can do it or not. Okay. And I actually don't have a good context. Not sure I'm very good at characterization and expressing the characters. I mean, the good fiction actually, the character comes out in the characters themselves and in the dialogue. Okay. I'm not sure I have that. I'm very happy that now I'm writing much more conversationally and even enticingly, even in this book. Okay. No, I'm too close to the grave, I'm afraid.
We'll see what happens, what you put out next. Stephen Penman, thank you so much for coming on Investing by the Books podcast to talk about you and your latest book, Financial Statement Analysis for Value Investing. Do you have something more you want to add here before we finish up?
No, I just encourage people to read the book. As I said, there's a web page which has a lot more supplementary materials both for the student but for the value investing, commentary on things of the day. So every chapter it updates with issues of the day and so on. Readers are encouraged to log in to respond to that, which some of them are doing. If you want to read my wider material, you can look at Penman on SSRN, I have a big website at the university. I'm not on social media much, okay? I've always not got onto social media, except they said, with this book, you've got to get onto LinkedIn, okay? Now, after the previous time with you, I get a lot of queries to join them on LinkedIn. I just didn't go because I was worried about that's a zoo. but this book, you see, it's published by Columbia University Press, and it's a non-profit. So it only costs $50, whereas the other text costs $250, okay? So I'm very happy that it's a cheap book. But they have no marketing. So they said, at least you've got to get on LinkedIn. So I am on LinkedIn now, okay? Where I talk more about the book and other issues. So I'm actually on there. So don't expect me entirely responsive to everything, but I'm sort of low profile sort of guy, okay? So just read me, okay?
Great, and are you planning on coming back to Omaha next year?
Probably not, okay. Although someone may twist my arm, but there's a purpose to it. Okay. I'd say it's less than 50%. Though I was in fact gratified by the experience last year. Okay, I think it was worthwhile. We'll see.
Wonderful. We'll see you at some point. Thank you so much, Stephen. Take care. All the best.
Okay, thank you, Martin. Thank you, Eddie. Thank you. All the best to you.
Thank you for listening to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. Follow us on Twitter at @IB_Redeye and email us at ib.podcast@redeye.se. To improve, we'd love to hear your feedback, so please rate and review us. Notice that the content in this podcast is not and shall not be construed as investment advice. This information is meant to be informative and for general purposes only. For full disclaimer, visit redeye.se. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and until next time, I sincerely wish you the best of luck on your journey through life and investing.